Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be tackling pancreatic cystic neoplasms, PCNs, and big topic for the SCE exam. And to guide us through this, we're using the guidelines from the European Study Group on cystic tumors of the pancreas.
This is a great
It
resource
is the great
for
resource.
anybody studying for this or just wanting to brush up.
So let's just jump right in.
All right.
How are these PCNs classified according to the WHO and
So the WHO classification basically divides them into neoplastic and non-neoplastic, and then further subclassifies them into things like IPMNs, MCNs, SCNs.
And why is it so important to distinguish between these different subtypes?
Well, it's challenging because they can have very similar appearances on imaging, particularly early on, and the management can be drastically different. One subtype might just need watchful waiting, whereas another one might need surgery right away.
So there are a lot of similarities between these different subtypes.
Absolutely.
So let's say you're evaluating a patient and you think they might have a PCN. Are there any blood tests we can use to like definitively diagnose the type or, even figure out malignant
I wish
potential?
there was a magic bullet blood test that we could use for these, but unfortunately, there really isn't. Now, CA 19 to 9, sometimes people consider it particularly for IPMNs and if there's a really high suspicion of malignancy, but even then, it's not 100%, and you really have to take it in the context of all the other clinical findings.
So no relying on blood tests for a clear-cut diagnosis. What about the cyst fluid?
Ah, so cyst fluid analysis, that's where things are getting exciting.
Okay.
So, analyzing the cyst fluid, particularly for USANS and KRAS mutations, using next-generation sequencing can be really helpful in determining if a cyst is mucinous or non-mucinous, and that can have a big impact on.
And that could change management.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow. So
It's
we're
really.
getting into like the molecular diagnostics.
Yeah, the molecular profile is becoming increasingly important.
What about amylase and lipase in the cyst fluid?
Yeah, so amylase and lipase, they have a little bit of a role, I guess.
So I
You
got.
know, an elevated amylase can help you rule out a pseudocyst,
Okay.
but it's not really going to help you differentiate between the different subtypes
Got it.
of PCNs.
Okay. So imaging is really going to be
Yeah.
key here.
Or that.
So MRI versus CT, which one is better for surveillance of PCNs?
So generally speaking, MRI, particularly with MRCP, is the preferred modality, especially for surveillance. And the reason for that is because you want to avoid exposing your patients to repeated CT scans and the radiation that comes with that.
Makes sense. What are the specific advantages of MRI over CT in terms of actually evaluating these lesions?
So MRI-MRCP offers a better visualization of the pancreatic duct. And so you can see if there's any communication between the cyst and the duct, which is a worrisome feature. It's also better at picking up mural nodules and septations within the cyst, which can also be suggestive of malignancy.
So it sounds like MRI is generally preferred, but I'm guessing CT still has its place in the work of PCNs.
Oh, absolutely. There are definitely times when a CT scan is going to be preferred. And so particularly if you're looking for calcifications, CT is better at picking those up. If you have a lesion that you're concerned is malignant, you want to get a CT scan for staging purposes. And then after somebody's had a resection, if you're worried about recurrence, then a CT scan is usually going to be
So
going to
basically,
start being.
kicking the best modality depends on what you're looking for.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no one size fits all.
All right. And are there like any specific protocols for CT or MRI that we should be following for PCNs?
So there's no strict protocol that everybody uses, but there is some interesting research suggesting that a short MRI protocol focusing on T2 weighted imaging and diffusion weighted imaging could be sufficient for surveillance. But more research is needed on that.
Okay, so let's move on to endoscopy now. Where does EUS fit in the diagnostic algorithm for PCNs?
So EUS is a great tool, but it's really an adjunct to cross-sectional imaging. It's really good at identifying worrisome features that might push you towards a resection.
So it can raise your concern, but it can't definitively tell you the subtype.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
What about contrast-enhanced EUS, CHEUS?
So CHEUS can be a really helpful tool, especially when you're evaluating mural nodules. It allows you to assess vascularity within the cyst and the septations, and that can give you some clues about malignant potential. And if you see hyperenhancement on CHEUS, that's a red flag, and you should really be thinking about doing an EUS guided fine needle aspiration or USFNA.
So that could actually like raise your level of concern and potentially lead to an FNA.
Yeah.
So let's talk about EUSFNA then. What are the indications and contraindications for using this in PCN evaluation?
So EUSFNA, you know, it shouldn't just be a knee-jerk reaction. Every time you see a cyst, you really should only be doing it if the results are going to influence your management decisions. Right. So if the diagnosis is already clear based on your imaging or if surgery is already planned, you probably don't need to do an FNA.
So you're trying to avoid those just-in-case FNAs?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So assuming that you do perform an EUSFNA, what are the key analyses that you'd want to run on the cyst load?
So the main things you're looking for are CEA levels, lipase levels, and then also the cytology.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things together can be really helpful in distinguishing between mucinous and non-mucinous cysts.
Okay.
And then increasingly people are looking at KRAS and GNAS mutations as well, although that's not necessarily standard of care everywhere.
Got it. So CEA, lipase cytology, our trusty trio.
Exactly.
What about brush cytology or forceps biopsy during USFNA?
So it can be tempting to want to get as much information as possible, but currently brush cytology and forceps biopsies are not recommended.
For PCNs?
For PCNs. There's just not enough evidence to support their use, and the accuracy really doesn't justify the added risk.
Interesting. So sometimes less is more?
Sometimes less is more. That's right.
Especially when the evidence isn't there.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's move on to the specifics of IPMNs now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some red flags that should raise your concern about an IPMN's malignant potential?
So with IPMNs, there are a few things that if you see them, you should immediately be worried.
Okay.
So jaundice, that's a big one.
Okay.
If you see jaundice in a patient with an IPMN, that's a really bad sign.
Yeah.
If you see an enhancing mural nodule, and particularly if it's 5 millimeters or larger, that's another big red flag.
Yeah, okay.
And then, of course, if you get cytology back and it's positive for malignancy,
right,
then that's obviously a big
problem. Rocks never good.
Never good.
No. What about the size of the main pancreatic duct?
Ah, yeah. So MPD dilatation, that's another key feature to pay attention to.
Okay.
So if you see dilatation of 5 millimeters or more, that's something to be concerned about. And then once you get to 10 millimeters or more, that's considered high risk, and you really need to think about surgery if the patient's a surgical candidate.
So 5 millimeters is concerning 10 millimeters. Like, we got to do something.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, what about the size of the IPMN itself? Does size matter?
Size does matter, but it's not the only thing that matters.
Okay.
So the guidelines kind of use a cutoff of 40 millimeters. So IPMNs that are larger than 40 millimeters are considered high risk, regardless of other features. But, you know, it's important to remember that not every IPMN that's bigger than 40 millimeters is cancer. You really have to look at the whole picture and see if there are other risk factors present.
So it's more of a holistic...
It's a holistic assessment.
Assessment, okay.
Yeah.
And there are different subtypes of IPMNs, right? MD-IPMN, MT-IPMN, and BD-IPMN.
That's right.
How does management differ between these subtypes?
So for MD-IPMN and MT-IPMN, the consensus is pretty clear.
Okay.
If the patient's a surgical candidate, you should resect. The risk of malignancy is just too high to just watch and wait.
Got it.
Now, BD-IPMN management, that's where things get a little bit more nuanced.
Okay.
The guidelines basically lay out some absolute and relative criteria for resection.
Okay. And can you go over what those are, those criteria for resection?
Yeah. So the absolute criteria are basically all those red flags we talked about before.
Okay.
So jaundice, positive cytology, a large enhancing mural nodule, and main pancreatic duct dilatation of 10 millimeters or more.
Got it.
Those are all automatic triggers for surgery.
Okay.
The relative criteria are a little bit more subtle.
Right.
So things like if the cyst is growing rapidly, so say 5 millimeters or more per year, new onset diabetes or pancreatitis, those are things that should raise your suspicion.
So even with BD-IPMNs, you know, keeping that low threshold for suspicion.
Yeah, you always got to be on the lookout.
It's important. So assuming surgery is the chosen path for an IPMN, what are the different surgical approaches and how do you choose the best one for a given patient?
So for the vast majority of BD-IPMNs, the standard approach is going to be an oncological resection with appropriate lymphadenectomy.
Okay.
You know, similar to what you would do for a pancreatic cancer.
Got it.
But there is another approach called parenchyma-sparing pancreatectomy, or PSP, and that's a less aggressive approach that aims to preserve as much healthy pancreatic tissue as possible.
Okay.
But that's really only appropriate for lesions that have a very low probability of malignancy.
So PSP is kind of like a special case.
Yeah, you got to be really careful with that one.
Okay. What about these challenging cases where you have a multifocal BDIPMN, you know, multiple cysts scattered throughout the pancreas?
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach those surgically?
So with multifocal BDIPMN, it's important to remember that each cyst needs to be evaluated individually.
Oh, okay.
Some cysts might have worrisome features and need to be resected, but others might be completely benign and can just be watched.
Okay, so it's not like a we got to take the whole thing out approach.
No, not at all.
Okay, now during an IPMN resection,
yeah,
do you recommend routine frozen section analysis?
Yes, absolutely. The guidelines recommend frozen section analysis for all partial pancreatectomies and PSPs, and that's to make sure that the resection margins are clear.
Right.
You don't want to leave any high-grade dysplasia or cancer at the margins because then you might need to extend the resection
right.
while you're in there.
But how often does that actually happen? How often does frozen section change surgical management?
You know, that's a bit of a debate in the field.
Okay.
The guidelines recommend it, but the evidence for its impact is kind of mixed.
Yep.
Some studies show that it changes surgical decisions quite frequently.
Mm.
Other studies suggest that it doesn't really have that much of an impact, but, you know, in my opinion, it's better to be safe than sorry.
Right. Especially with
these lesions.
These potentially malignant
yeah.
lesions. What if the frozen section does show high-grade dysplasia or even cancer at the margin? What do you do then?
So if you see high-grade dysplasia at the margin, you really need to think about extending the resection. But it doesn't always mean that you have to do a total pancreatectomy.
Uh-huh.
It really depends on the patient's overall health, their age, their other risk factors.
So again, it goes back to
individualized decision-making.
That individualized approach.
Exactly.
Okay. Before we move on from IPMNs, I want to talk about post-resection surveillance. Are these patients truly in the clear after surgery, or what do we have to do?
Unfortunately, no resection is not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Okay.
So lifelong surveillance is recommended for patients who have had an IPMN resection as long as they're fit and willing to undergo further surgery if needed.
Okay, so lifelong surveillance.
Yeah.
Why is it so important to keep following these patients so closely?
So there's always a risk of recurrence.
Okay.
And that risk varies depending on the type of IPMN.
Okay.
And whether or not there was dysplasia or invasive carcinoma present.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always there.
Okay.
So that's why we need to be vigilant.
So what's the preferred modality and like how often should we be surveying these patients?
So the preferred modality is either MRI or EUS.
Okay.
And the frequency really depends on the grade of dysplasia.
So it's like a tiered approach.
Kind of a step up approach, yeah.
All right, so now let's shift gears and talk about MCNs, mucinous cystic neoplasms. What are the essential points that we need to know about these lesions?
So MCNs are a little less common than IPMNs.
Okay.
But they can also be malignant.
Okay.
They tend to have a slightly better prognosis than IPMNs, but we still approach them with caution.
All right.
And the guidelines give us some pretty clear recommendations about when we should be resecting an MCN.
Can you go over those for us?
Yeah. So any MCN that's 40 millimeters or larger should be resected.
Okay.
We also recommend resection regardless of size.
Okay.
If the MCN is causing symptoms or if it has any worrisome features on imaging like a mural nodule.
So again, that 40 millimeter cutoff.
Yeah.
And we're always respecting those red flags.
Okay.
What about smaller MCNs? Those that are less than 40 millimeters, can those be safely observed?
So MCNs that are smaller than 40 millimeters and don't have any concerning features can generally be monitored.
Okay.
But we still recommend lifelong surveillance.
Okay.
So we usually start with imaging every 6 months for the first year.
Okay.
And then if it's stable, we can go to annually.
Okay. So lifelong surveillance, again, it seems like that's a common theme.
Yeah, it is a common theme.
With PCNs, why is this necessary even for MCNs, which are typically less aggressive than IPMNs?
So while MCNs are usually slower growing than IPMNs, they can still become malignant over time. So the guidelines basically say it's better to be safe than sorry.
Right.
And just keep an eye on them.
Okay, so a more relaxed schedule than for those high-risk IPMNs, but still we're emphasizing long-term monitoring.
Exactly.
Okay, now on to the good guys. The cerocystic neoplasms. The SCNs, these are generally considered benign, right?
That's right. SCNs are almost always benign. Okay, have near zero malignant potential and essentially no associated mortality.
So when you see an SCN on imaging, can you just breathe a sigh of relief and move on? Or do you need to do any follow-up?
So while SCNs are, you know, overwhelmingly benign, we still like to get at least a one-year follow-up just to be sure. And then after that, we can usually transition to symptom-based monitoring.
Okay.
So we basically only investigate if the patient develops new symptoms.
Got it. So if everything's stable, you pretty much just leave it alone.
Pretty much, yeah.
What are the indications for surgery then in those rare cases where an SCN does cause problems?
So surgery for SCNs is very rare.
Okay.
And it's really only indicated if the lesion is causing significant symptoms due to compression of adjacent organs.
Okay.
So things like bile duct obstruction or stomach or duodenal compression.
Got it. So it's only when that SCN becomes like a...
Yeah, a space-occupying lesion.
A bully.
Yeah.
That we have to intervene. Okay, so we've covered the major players, IPMNs, MCNs, SCNs. What about those less common or undefined cystic tumors? What's the strategy when you encounter one of those?
So when you find a cyst that's not one of the usual suspects,
right,
your first job is to try to figure out what it is.
Okay.
And that often involves a combination of imaging and EUS.
Right.
And possibly an FNA if needed.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidelines actually have a really helpful diagnostic algorithm.
Oh, okay.
Based on the cyst size and how certain you are about the diagnosis.
So there's like a systematic approach we can...
Yeah, there's a framework you can follow.
What about surveillance recommendations for these undefined cysts?
So the surveillance guidelines for undefined cysts are actually pretty similar to the ones for MCNs.
Okay.
So if the cyst is smaller than 15 millimeters, you can re-examine it after a year.
Okay.
And then potentially extend that to every 2 years if it's stable.
Okay.
But if it's 15 millimeters or larger, then we recommend annual surveillance.
Okay. So being a little more cautious with those larger cysts. Now, is lifelong monitoring really necessary for these undefined cysts, even though we don't really know what they are?
So the guidelines do recommend lifelong monitoring.
For undefined cysts.
For undefined cysts, because there's always a chance that they could be mucinous and therefore have some malignant potential.
Right.
However, there is a caveat to that recommendation.
Okay.
That is that it really depends on the patient's surgical candidacy.
Okay.
So if a patient is unlikely to be a candidate for surgery down the line,
yeah,
then the benefit of continuous surveillance is questionable.
So again, a judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about treatment options beyond surgery. What's the current thinking on adjuvant and neoadjuvant therapies for PCNs, especially those with invasive carcinoma?
Okay, so for IPMNs with invasive carcinoma, the guidelines actually recommend adjuvant chemotherapy.
Regardless of lymph node involvement.
Regardless of lymph node involvement, that's right.
Okay.
Now, there aren't any specific recommendations about what the optimal regimen is. But the most commonly used drugs are 5-fluorosil and gemcitabine.
Okay.
Which is similar to what we use for pancreatic adenocarcinoma.
So we're kind of drawing on...
Yeah, we're kind of borrowing from the pancreatic cancer literature.
What about MCN-associated carcinoma? Is adjuvant therapy recommend there as well?
So for MCN-associated carcinoma, the approach is also similar to pancreatic adenocarcinoma.
Okay.
Although the evidence there is more limited.
Okay.
And again, there's no clearly defined chemotherapy regimen.
So extrapolating from the pancreatic cancer data, which I guess makes sense.
Yeah, it's the best we can do.
And what about neoadjuvant therapy?
So neoadjuvant therapy is not routinely recommended for most PCNs, including those with invasive carcinoma.
Okay.
There is one exception, though.
Okay.
And that's solid pseudopapillary neoplasms, or SPNs.
Got it.
And for SPNs, neoadjuvant therapy is generally not indicated.
Okay, so neoadjuvant is largely...
Yeah, off the table.
Off the table, except for SPNs. Okay, before we wrap up this section, I want to touch on pathology. How should a PCN specimen be handled and analyzed to ensure an accurate diagnosis?
So accurate pathology is really the cornerstone of this whole thing.
Of everything.
When you resect a PCN, that specimen needs to be carefully examined and the report needs to be comprehensive.
Okay.
So you want to document things like the size and location of the cyst.
Okay.
The presence of any mural nodules or solid components, the histological subtype.
Okay.
And the grade of dysplasia.
So a lot of details to keep track of.
It's a lot of information, yeah.
Are there any specific recommendations for handling IPMN specimens, given that they could be so pathologically complex?
Yeah. So for IPMNs, there are some specific reporting guidelines.
Okay.
So the pathologist should document the histological subtype.
Okay.
So whether it's gastric, intestinal, pancreatobiliary, or oncocytic.
Got it.
And they also need to grade the dysplasia as either low grade or high grade. And then if there's any invasive carcinoma present, that needs to be thoroughly described as well.
Okay. So again, a lot of
details.
Details. Any special considerations for MCN specimens?
So for MCNs, the guidelines also recommend a two-tiered dysplasia grading system.
Similar to IPMNs.
Similar to IPMNs, yep.
Okay.
But there is one important terminology change to be aware of.
Okay, what's that?
So terms like malignant MCN, invasive MCN, or mucinous cystadenocarcinoma, those are all outdated.
Oh, okay.
And they should be replaced with MCN with associated invasive carcinoma.
Okay.
And that's to align with the WHO and UICC recommendations.
So being very specific with our language.
Precise language is important.
Yes. Okay, great. So we've covered a lot of ground here, exploring the ins and outs of PCNs, their diagnosis, and their management. Do you have any final pearls of wisdom for our listeners as we move on to some case examples?
You know, I think the most important thing to remember is that even experienced gastroenterologists find PCNs challenging.
Yeah.
So don't try to memorize every single detail of the guidelines.
Yeah.
Instead, focus on understanding the key risk factors.
Okay.
The rationale behind the different management strategies.
Mm.
And the general surveillance schedules.
Okay.
You know, break it down into manageable chunks.
Right.
And don't be afraid to refer back to the guidelines as needed.
That's great advice. And of course, the world of gastroenterology is constantly evolving.
Always changing, yeah.
So staying curious.
Absolutely.
Keeping up with the literature is really important.
Very important.
All right. Well, I think it's time to put on our detective hats and walk through some real life scenarios.
Sounds good.
To see how these concepts play out in practice. Are you ready to tackle some cases?
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay, so let's start with our first case. Imagine a 65-year-old woman with a history of hypertension who presents for a routine checkup. She's totally asymptomatic. But an abdominal ultrasound incidentally picks up a 2-centimeter cyst in the tail of her pancreas. A subsequent MRI with MRCP confirms the cyst, and it looks like a BD-IPMN, no mural nodules, no dilation of the MPD, and no communication with the duct. The patient is understandably a bit anxious about this finding. How would you approach this situation?
Well, this is a very common scenario, an incidental pancreatic cyst. You know, small asymptomatic imaging suggests a BD-IPMN without any red flags. So this is where those European guidelines really come in handy.
Exactly. In this case, the cyst is less than 40 millimeters and it doesn't have any of those high risk features we talked about. So surgery wouldn't be our first step. We'd reassure the patient and recommend a surveillance plan.
And what would that surveillance plan look like for this particular patient?
So because it's smaller than 3 centimeters, we would follow the guidelines for both MCNs and IPMNs. Under that size, we'd recommend a follow-up MRI in a year to check for any changes. And if it's stable, then we could consider extending the surveillance interval to every 2 years.
Okay, so watch and wait, but with careful monitoring makes sense. Now, let's say we have a 70-year-old man with a history of smoking and chronic pancreatitis who presents with painless jaundice imaging. Reveals a 5-centimeter cyst in the head of the pancreas involving the main pancreatic duct and causing upstream dilation. What are your initial thoughts on this case?
So this case is a bit more concerning. Right off the bat, we have a couple of red flags that should make us worry. The painless jaundice, the size of the cyst, over 40 millimeters, the main pancreatic duct involvement with upstream dilatation, all of these things point toward a possible MD-IPMN.
And his history of smoking and chronic pancreatitis probably adds to the concern, too.
Well, smoking and chronic pancreatitis do increase the risk of pancreatic cancer in general. They don't specifically predict IPMN behavior. But in this case, the combination of those high-risk features along with his history would make me strongly consider surgical resection, assuming, of course, he's a good candidate for surgery.
And given the location of the cyst and the main pancreatic duct involvement, what kind of resection would you be thinking about?
For a cyst in the head of the pancreas like this involving the main pancreatic duct, a pancreatoduodenectomy or Whipple procedure would be the standard approach.
And would you recommend frozen section analysis during the surgery?
Absolutely. Frozen section analysis of the resection margins is critical in this case to make sure we got all of the lesion and to help guide any decisions about extending the resection if needed.
Okay, so a much more aggressive approach is definitely warranted in this case because of that high suspicion of malignancy. Okay, one more case before we move on. A 45-year-old woman comes in with recurrent episodes of acute pancreatitis imaging, shows a 3-centimeter cyst in the body of the pancreas, and importantly, there's a 1-centimeter enhancing mural nodule within the cyst. The cyst itself doesn't seem to involve the main pancreatic duct. What would be your next step in managing this patient?
This case is a good example of how the clinical presentation and the imaging findings work together. So while the cyst itself isn't huge, that enhancing mural nodule, particularly at that size, is a big red flag. And the recurrent pancreatitis also makes us worry. It all points to a potentially malignant IPMN.
So even though the cyst is small, that mural nodule and the recurrent pancreatitis make you think about surgical resection.
Yeah, exactly. I would definitely recommend surgical resection, even though the cyst isn't bigger than 40 millimeters and doesn't involve the main pancreatic duct. Those other features are just too concerning.
And what type of resection would you do in this case?
So in this case, because the cyst is in the body of the pancreas and it's not involving the main duct, a distal pancreatectomy would probably be the best way to go. And as we've talked about before, frozen section analysis during surgery is essential to check those margins.
These three cases really illustrate how managing PCNs requires a very individualized approach. You know, cyst size location, worrisome features, the patient's symptoms, it all factors in.
Absolutely. These cases are rarely straightforward, and you really need a good understanding of the guidelines and solid clinical judgment to make the best decisions for your patients.
Well said. Now, before we move on to the last part of our deep dives into PCNs, let's take a minute to revisit those European guidelines. Is there anything in particular you'd like to emphasize again for our listeners, particularly those getting ready for the SCE exam?
I think one of the most important things to remember from the guidelines is that lifelong surveillance is necessary for most PCNs, even after surgery. You know, these lesions can come back, so it's essential to be vigilant and monitor appropriately. We can't just assume that surgery means they're cured.
That's a really good point. Ongoing surveillance is key. Is there anything else you'd like to highlight?
I think it's also worth mentioning the role of molecular diagnostics, which are becoming increasingly important in PCN management. Analyzing the cyst fluid for mutations like KRA and GNS can give us really valuable information that can directly impact our management decisions. This is a rapidly evolving area, and I expect we'll see even more progress in the coming years.
I completely agree. Molecular diagnostics are definitely becoming more and more important in gastroenterology, and PCNs are no exception. Now, I know we've covered a ton of information today. It's probably a lot to process, but I think it's time to tackle some of the most challenging aspects of PCNs in our final segment. We'll delve into those really tricky scenarios that often stump even the most experienced gastroenterologists and offer some expert tips for navigating the complexities of PCN diagnosis and management.
Sounds great. Let's dive in and see what other PCN puzzles we can solve.
Okay, so let's get back into those challenging PCN scenarios and put our knowledge to the test.
Right, sounds good. Let's start with a case that really emphasizes the importance of considering patient preferences. So imagine we have a 75-year-old patient with a 1.5 centimeter SCN, and they're asymptomatic, otherwise healthy, but they really don't like the idea of getting frequent scans. How would you approach surveillance in this case?
Well, you know, this is a great case because it really highlights the importance of balancing those guideline recommendations with the individual patient's needs and preferences. And in this case, we have a patient who meets the criteria for surveillance, but isn't really thrilled about undergoing imaging.
Exactly. And we know SCNs have a very, very low malignant potential. So how can we respect the patient's wishes, but still make sure we're monitoring things appropriately?
I think communication is really key here. You know, sit down with the patient, explain the rationale behind surveillance, but acknowledge their concerns. And maybe we could compromise and say, okay, instead of an MRI, how about we do a follow-up ultrasound in a year? It might not be as sensitive as MRI, but it could give us some reassurance without exposing the patient to radiation.
Yeah, that's a great approach. Finding that middle ground is so important. Mm. All right, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a case that presents a different kind of dilemma. Let's say you have a patient with an IPMN that meets the criteria for resection, but they're not a surgical candidate because of severe cardiac disease. What do you do in that situation?
That's a tough one. You know, surgery is really considered the gold standard for high-risk IPMNs, but this patient's comorbidities make that impossible. So you might be thinking, okay, what about ablative techniques? But
as we talked about before, ablative therapies for IPMNs are still considered experimental and really should only be done in a clinical trial setting. So that's not something we would routinely recommend outside of that context.
Right. So unfortunately, in this case, we're probably left with close observation and managing the patient's symptoms the best we can. It's not the ideal scenario, but sometimes it's the most appropriate course of action.
It really highlights the importance of careful patient selection for surveillance in the first place. All right, one last case to really drive these points home. Imagine you've resected a BDI-PMN. The margins are clear, but the pathology report shows high-grade dysplasia. What does your postoperative surveillance strategy look like for this patient?
Okay, so high-grade dysplasia, even with clear margins, still means there's a higher risk of recurrence. So we definitely need to be more vigilant with our follow-up. In this case, the guidelines recommend a more intensive surveillance schedule compared to a patient with low-grade dysplasia.
So how would you actually translate that into a surveillance plan?
So for a patient with high-grade dysplasia like this, I would recommend an MRI every 6 months for the first 2 years, and then annually after that, if the dysplasia had been low-grade, we could probably just stick with yearly MRIs.
Perfect. You've got those surveillance recommendations can be tricky, so it's great that you've mastered them. Now, taking a step back from these specific cases, what advice would you give to someone who's feeling a bit overwhelmed by all of this information about PCNs?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that even experienced gastroenterologists find PCNs be really challenging. So don't beat yourself up if you're feeling a little overwhelmed. Don't try to memorize every single detail of the guidelines. Instead, focus on understanding the key risk factors, the logic behind the different management strategies and the general surveillance schedules. You know, break it down into smaller pieces and use those guidelines as a reference when you need them.
That's great advice. And you know, this field is always changing, so it's important to stay curious, keep learning, and don't be afraid to ask questions.
Well said. This deep dive has definitely given me a much better grasp of PCNs, and I feel much more confident in approaching these cases. I hope our listeners feel the same way.
And to all of our listeners out there who are studying for the SCE exam, just remember, PCNs are tough, but if you focus on those key concepts, really understand the guidelines, and trust your clinical judgment, you'll be able to tackle those exam questions. And most importantly, you'll be able to provide the best possible care for your patients.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Best of luck with your studies, and until next time, keep exploring the amazing world of gastroenterology.
We'll see you on our next deep dive.